This is an ABC podcast.
Yeah, there are generally two types of people in the world, those who are good at maths and the rest of us. But why do some of us struggle so much with numbers? Hey, it's Dave Marchese with you on Hack, and we're looking at something called dyscalculia. You probably haven't heard of it, but experts reckon a lot of students live with it. Also coming up, the latest from the war in Ukraine with desperate pleas for a ceasefire. But first,
Hack.
I take this opportunity to acknowledge that the Liberal Party are not our enemies. They may be our adversary.
On Triple J.
During the pandemic, we got to know our state and territory leaders a lot more. You probably even know them by their first names now. Dan, Anastasia, Dom, who could forget Gladys? Well, now we've got a new one. Peter Malinauskas has been sworn in today as the Premier of South Australia after Labor's landslide election win in SA over the weekend. The Libs copped a bit of a hammering, and so now everyone's asking, could this be a sign ahead of the federal election in the next couple of months? Well, let's ask someone who can help us break it down. You'll probably know him from TV. He's always crunching numbers on his big screen. The ABC's Casey Briggs is with us from Adelaide. G'day, Casey.
G'day, David. Good to see you.
Yeah, nice to speak with you. It's being described as a landslide win. How big was this victory for Labor?
Yeah, for an election that a lot of, you know, people were saying was very hard to pick, the leaders were saying it was going to be a very close race, this has turned out to be quite a convincing and clear win for Labor. Labor have had swings to them virtually everywhere in the state. They've won at least 6 seats from the Liberal Party. That gives them 26. You need 24 for a majority. So they're clear of easily coming to government in their own right. And there are still more seats that they could well pick up. And one of the seats that they're in the hunt for is the former Premier, Stephen Marshall's own seat of Dunstan. At the moment, Labor's slightly ahead there, actually beating Stephen Marshall. That might turn around, though, when the pre-polls and postals are counted over the coming days. And we've seen relatively uniform swings, you know, across all parts of Adelaide. So there are now some very safe Labor seats. The other problem, though, for the Liberal Party is they've lost a lot of skin to Labor. And they're losing a lot of skin in regional and rural areas to, including some surprise, really close contests where independents are doing very well. They've lost the regional seat of Stewart to an independent MP. That's knocked off the former Deputy Premier from his own seat. Then there are, in regional areas, 3 more seats that are too close to call at this point, but independents are putting up very strong challenges. So the Liberal Party actually has, a bit of a challenge here on multiple flanks. They've lost vote. One of the factors in this election was SA Best, the party that Nick Xenophon led when he was trying to become Premier 4 years ago. They picked up 14% of the vote 4 years ago, and that was taken from both Labor and the Liberal Party in kind of roughly equal measure back then. But it looks like virtually none of that 14% has gone back to the Liberals this time. It's gone to Labor, and it's gone to a lot of other smaller parties and independents. It looks like there are a lot of people looking to park their vote somewhere other than with the Liberal Party.
Yeah, interesting. I want to get on to the new Premier now, Peter Malinauskas. We've got a text from Olivia in that says, is he that hell-jacked politician? Yeah, I mean, I've seen him described as a buff political leader. He's pretty young. He's 41. And he likes a good morning run. We know that. We saw that in the last few weeks of the campaign. He's obviously pretty popular with voters as well, Casey.
Yeah, I knew he was a fit guy beforehand. I didn't know quite how fit until he took his top off at the Adelaide Aquatic Centre during the campaign. You're right, this is a relatively young guy, 41. I think that makes him the second youngest Premier in the country after Dominic Perrottet in New South Wales. He's been in Parliament for, not as long as many others in Parliament. He's a relatively fresh face. But this is a man who's been quite involved with politics in South Australia for quite a long time. When he was in his 20s, there were Labor party officials and people associated with the Labor Party already then talking about him as potentially being a future Premier. He was one of the key figures in the removal of Mike Rann as South Australian Premier more than a decade ago. This is a man who's lived and breathed politics and lived and breathed the Labor Party for a very long time, and he came to the Parliament after holding the position as the head of the shoppies union, the retail workers union, the STA, in South Australia. And yeah, right, he's proven that with, you know, quite a comprehensive campaign. I don't think anyone is really saying that the Liberal Party put up much of a campaign against Labor here. Proven himself to be quite the popular guy. Of course, once he's now in office, once he's now the Premier, we'll see if that shine continues, because he's made a lot of promises, particularly on the health, in the health policy around ambulance ramping, around pandemic management, and around hospital funding. And health is obviously a very tricky part of public policy that a lot of governments have come unstuck on.
What about the old Premier Stephen Marshall? Do we think his loss was due to COVID policies? That was obviously a big thing over the past couple of years. Or could it have something to do with the federal government and voters not being happy with the Prime Minister, Scott Morrison?
Yeah, it's a good question. How much is this federal drag factor? You know, the PM, Scott Morrison, is, according to all the published polling, not particularly popular at the moment. And is that rubbing off on Stephen Marshall? I mean, I think Stephen Marshall got a pretty good rap and was supported even by the opposition leader, Peter Malinauskas, through most of the pandemic for his handling of it. But some of that shine seemed to come off when the state borders opened in November last year. There were criticisms that when that happened and when Omicron first made its way into Australia, he perhaps wasn't following the advice of his chief health officer to the letter, who had suggested maybe closing the borders again would be a good idea. I think some of the disruptions we saw, particularly over Christmas in South Australia, with issues around testing, with issues around people's, you know, Christmases getting cancelled because of close contact rules and because people were getting COVID, I think that definitely played a part here. And the government sort of campaigned on its record, but in many ways that record, you know, it was almost like it was a campaign that was designed 6 months ago on the record that the government had at the time before the Omicron wave began for the state and before we saw all of those issues around that really bumpy road to COVID normal that South Australia went down, you know, to kind of marrying up the COVID response with other states. That was a rocky road, and I think it probably did cause some issues in many voters' eyes.
We are seeing a lot of people draw conclusions and say, oh, this is showing us this ahead of the federal election. Are state election results that happen just before a federal election usually a good indicator of what might happen in the big national poll?
I think that, you know, we were talking about this in the newsroom today. It's not nothing, but it's also not everything. You know, you would have to think that, you know, if you looked at, in terms of federal electorates in South Australia, the most competitive one, really probably the only one in serious play, is the seat of Boothby. And virtually all of the state seats that overlap with Boothby have turned red in this election, including some once safe seats that weren't really thought to be in play before Saturday night. And so you might kind of look at those results and think, yeah, there could well be a swing on in Boothby. This is a seat that Labor would hope to pick up. It's the most marginal seat in the state. But as we've just talked about, there were also a lot of state issues, and we know that this was a campaign fought on a whole series of local political issues, from issues around local hospitals and ramping to COVID management to the building of an entertainment centre and a basketball stadium to all of those sorts of kind of local issues. And so, and we've seen in the past that, you know, voters can tell the difference between a state and a federal government and the state and federal issues. We've seen a long history of voters in one state, in some states, you know, Queensland's a good example. They vote for Labor state governments in recent history a fair bit, but they return Liberals to the federal arena. So, you know, I think it's something that would be absolutely giving the federal government and federal MPs some pause for thought, but I don't think it's everything here. These are issues that will be fought on very different issues with very different leaders, and so I think you'd be naive to try and, you know, to make the assumption that a seat like Boothby would be, you know, automatically won by Labor after seeing the results over the weekend.
All right, well, we don't have long to wait, so we'll see in a few weeks. Casey Briggs, thank you very much for your time. Appreciate you coming on Hack.
Thank you.
We're hearing from you on the text line as well. Someone says, looks like Labor are running most of the states these days. Yeah, you're right. It's only New South Wales and Tasmania now that have Liberal national governments. And then somebody else says, it'll be really interesting to see how Western Australia votes at the federal election too. If they vote in any way like they did at the state election, the Libs are in trouble there.
Hack, I'm a woman in her 20s who cannot read a clock. And I'm aware that this is so easy for other people.
On Triple J.
Have you ever been told you just don't have a head for maths? Probably not Casey Briggs. I don't imagine he was ever told that. But maybe you tell yourself that every time you have to count on your fingers or you're trying to split a bill or even work out a bus timetable. It's definitely me. I feel like I used to give up on maths tests before I'd even start them. And let's be honest, maths is not easy. But for some people, not being able to do simple calculations is actually a neurological disorder. It's called dyscalculia. You might have heard of dyslexia. It's kind of like that, but with numbers instead. It's not as well known. Maybe you live with dyscalculia. I want to know. 1300 055 536, or you can message in as well. 0439 757 555. Maddie King looks into it.
It was just a real big struggle, and I really didn't think I would ever be able to do simple maths.
When Kira Lee was little, so much of maths, like ratios and division, was complete gibberish to her. She struggled to do the calculations in her head, and no matter how teachers explained the concepts to her, it just didn't make sense. Even when she was diagnosed with this condition, dyscalculia, it was so unknown that teachers couldn't really help her. In fact, they might have made it worse.
Unfortunately, some of the teachers just made it seem like I was a lazy student. I was made to feel really small. It was really difficult because I really wanted to try and succeed, but like I was too scared to ask questions again because they just didn't understand why I wasn't getting it.
If you've never heard of dyscalculia before, and I totally hadn't until a few weeks ago, it's essentially a disability that stops people processing what numbers mean. Math signs like multiplication and subtraction can be really confusing too.
Dyscalculia is an inability to recognise the numerical magnitude of a set of objects. We'd really be looking at something like understanding that a set of six objects, six dots for instance, has a value of six, and those six objects can be broken into three sets of two, or two sets of three, or a four and a two, all these sort of the set-based combinations.
Dr. Jacob Paul is a cognitive neuroscientist from Melbourne Uni, and he studies math disorders like dyscalculia. He says not much research has been done on the condition in Australia, but it's estimated up to 15% of students have dyscalculia or a specific maths learning disorder, which is roughly the same as dyslexia. But dyslexia gets about 50 times more research funding.
Definitely in the last two decades, I'd say at least, if not longer, has certainly skewed towards funding for language and literacy. That's not to say that that money needs to be diverted to focus on dyscalculia and numeracy. It's just more money needs to be put in the pot generally.
Jan Daly is an educational consultant with Spelled South Australia. They're an organisation that supports people with learning difficulties, and they've got branches across Australia. Jan helps a bunch of young people at the moment with dyscalculia.
Number has been, I believe, very abstract in a lot of ways, and what we have to do is make it meaningful for the student, help them see that number is part of their everyday life and it's not scary.
She says visuals can be really helpful, so like using number charts or even a ruler to keep track of things. As are, and I cannot stress this enough, calculators.
Do not be scared to use a calculator. I mean, we've got calculators, we all use it now, but sometimes we think, oh, maybe we shouldn't. This is an excuse, you know. No, it's not. This is a disability and you cannot help that. You've got to find the strategies that work for you.
For Kira Lee, things started to really click once she got to TAFE. Getting away from the stress of school and exams plus some new methods of teaching helped her to finally put things together, which is pretty crucial in her life as a professional baker.
I knew how to half things and, like, how to change recipes and, like, I understood, like, weighing of ingredients and everything.
If you're still with me and you're thinking, shit, maybe I have dyscalculia, I've got some mixed news for you. Less good news, getting a diagnosis can be really expensive. You'll have to see an educational psychologist who'll run a bunch of tests to see if you meet the criteria. better news, getting that diagnosis and support could help you use maths more confidently in everyday life. It might even help clear up some childhood trauma.
What it does is help them, one, understand that this wasn't their fault. They weren't being silly. They weren't that silly kid sitting in the back of the classroom just mucking around. There was a reason that they couldn't comprehend what the teacher was talking about or couldn't do the calculations.
Kiralee just wants to see some more awareness about dyscalculia.
People don't really believe it exists. So people just think you're just making up something up to make you get out of doing maths. It needs to be put out there properly. So, like, the right help can be given to people, or else people will just suffer not learning at all.
Hack on Triple J.
Yeah, Maddie King with that story, and it's definitely struck a chord with a lot of you. We're hearing from Alice from Melbourne saying, yes, I have dyscalculia and struggle so hard with numbers. I see 4 and 6 as the same number, and I'll read numbers backwards and was constantly called lazy because I'm good at English but can't do maths. Somebody else says, I remember sitting in class in primary school, moving my mouth and pretending to say my times tables with the rest of the class when really I had no idea. And Kristen, you say, I have this. I didn't know it had a real name. I've been calling it number dyslexia for the past 12 years. I suffered all through high school just thinking I must have been not smart and couldn't do anything about it. It wasn't until I went to uni and spoke to my friends that I realised I had a genuine problem. Not the easiest to work with when you're an ecologist and have to manage a lot of numbers and data for statistical analysis. It's incredibly hard for me, but I've learnt to manage it by being careful and slow with what I'm processing. Yes, yeah, some big comments coming through. A lot of you saying you really struggle with numbers. Also, it's World Maths Day on Wednesday, so definitely a really good time to be talking about this stuff.
Hack.
The Constitution is the birth certificate of this nation, and it's missing someone. It's missing us. Aboriginal people.
On Triple Jack.
Almost 5 years ago, First Nations leaders from across the country came together at Uluru to make history. They came up with a statement calling for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people to have a voice to the Australian Parliament enshrined in the Constitution. It's called the Uluru Statement from the Heart. But even though it was created back in 2017 and there's been a lot of talk from politicians, nothing's happened. And young First Nations people are frustrated. Well, with me now is Alira Davis. She's a Cobble Cobble woman and she's with the Uluru Youth Dialogues. Alira, thanks for coming on Hack.
Thanks so much. Very excited to be here.
When we talk about having a First Nations voice to Parliament enshrined in the Constitution, what exactly does that mean, Alira?
So for me, it means having a permanent and legitimate voice where government has to listen to us and hear our voices. I know people kind of steer away from, oh, hearing about the Constitution and, you know, I mean, I've never read the Constitution. I've read sections of it. However, you've got to understand that the Constitution is our book of laws and government follows that. If we have a permanent voice in there and a First Nations voice in there, they have to listen to us. And we've always had kind of a seat outside the table, but never, I guess, in the table, if that makes sense, or at the table.
Yeah, for sure. Well, to have that voice enshrined in the Constitution, would we need to have a referendum, like a vote, asking everyone in the country whether they think that should happen?
Yes, we would. And what's, I think, amazing about this journey and what's so powerful about this journey is that the only way you can change the Constitution is going to a referendum. And I think a majority of us young people haven't actually ever experienced a referendum. So I think that's the most powerful thing that comes from it. And the Constitution is never supposed to be changed. So once we have that enshrined voice in the Australian Constitution, then government and people have to listen to us on laws and policies that affect us.
I imagine that through your work, you've probably seen a bit of research, you've talked to people. Does the research show there is a lot of support for the ideas in the Statement from the Heart in the broader community?
Yeah, for sure. So just to give a bit of background, like my travels with the Uluru Statement from the Heart journey, I've gone on to a lot of art fairs and music festivals and you know, one thing that really stands out for me is the non-Indigenous support that we get. You know, people just saying, you know, you just want a voice. That's literally it. That's the simple message. You just want a voice enshrined in the Constitution and that's it. I mean, we just want to be heard basically in our own country. We are the traditional owners of this land and, you know, we have that right to be recognised for our culture and our beautiful land that we offer to everyone.
There's the voice to Parliament, but what else is in the statement from the heart? There are other things in there, right?
There are. There's the Uluru Statement calls for three reforms: voice, treaty, truth. Right now we are looking at a voice, because that is probably the most strategic way we can try and change laws and policies that affect us in communities. And people have to remember it is from a grassroots level. So we do have the Uluru Dialogues, who are the cultural authority, to talk about, you know, educate people about the Uluru Statement. But that's the main, the three reforms that we call for. And treaty will obviously be in each state and territory. And then truth-telling will be the overarching element, which is bringing a Makarrata Commission to government and Australia.
And, I mean, you have been pushing for action on the statement for years, along with a lot of other First Nations people across the country. Did you ever think that 5 years on from the statement coming out that we'd still be waiting for action?
That's a good question. Yes and no. I think, especially with Indigenous issues in general, it does take a while to kick off, unfortunately. And we've been talking about this for decades as well. I mean, constitutional recognition was, I guess, born in 2011, and we've been kind of fighting for the same message ever since. And I think, yeah, we just need to keep pushing for it. And I think what's important about my role as a youth manager for the Uluru Youth Dialogue is getting our young people, especially, to educate everyone. I mean, we have social media out there that, you know, there's pros and cons to it, but it's sharing the message and making sure that people just understand the key message, which is we want a voice, a First Nations voice enshrined in the Constitution. I feel sad sometimes and upset because, you know, our ancestors, our elders have been fighting for a voice for, you know, since colonisation. But I also kind of feel a fire in my belly as well to help and try and, you know, educate people on why we need a voice and why is it so important. And unfortunately, some of the people who signed the statement have passed on now. And, you know, we need to fight for what's right and fight for our ancestors and elders who fought so many years to try and get this voice, because it's so important for us to change, you know, our statistics, to change our health system, to change our incarceration rates and our children out of home care, and to try and put them in families with our families, and just make sure that, yeah, we can gain a voice for the people who have passed on, and for the people who for generations to come.
And we are coming up to a federal election, and now starting to see a bit more conversation about this. First Nations leaders and advocates like yourself are coming out and saying, hey, don't wait for politicians. It's up to the community to really be pushing for this as well. What is your advice to young people out there, First Nations young people, but also other people in the community?
I urge Australians to do your research once you understand the key message, which is the First Nations people's want a voice in their country. Write a letter to your MP. Follow us on all of our socials for key updates. It's Uluru, at Uluru Statement. Check out our website. We have so many good resources and links explaining the Uluru Statement from the heart. And, you know, we have the Uluru Statement in over 50 different languages. So please go check that out.
Alira Davis, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Hack on Triple J.
Yeah, and the Morrison government last year said it was preparing to consider legislation to establish an Indigenous voice to Parliament, but it hasn't happened. Labor has pledged to enact the Uluru Statement in its entirety if it's elected.
There is no Mariupol. We sat in the cellar for 10 days and did not leave once.
Russia has committed nearly all possible war crimes.
Every minute some people of Mariupol are dying.
What the occupiers did to this peaceful city is a terror that will be remembered for centuries to come.
There is no help.
On Triple J.
Yeah, it's been a minute since we've got an update from Ukraine, and since then a lot's happened. More civilians have been killed, more talks have failed, and Ukraine's rejected demands by Russia for them to surrender an important city. So it's time for an update. With me now is Dr. Matthew Sussex from ANU's Strategic and Defence Studies Centre. Matthew, thanks for coming on Hack.
Thanks, Dave.
A lot of the major fighting at the moment seems to be happening in the southern city of Mariupol. We're hearing about 90% of buildings there have been damaged or destroyed, and hundreds of thousands of people are short on power, water and food. Why is this city so important for Russia?
Well, there's three basic reasons. The first reason is that Russia wants to cut off Ukraine from being able to access the sea. And there are two seas that Ukraine has access to. It's the Sea of Azov and the Black Sea. And Mariupol's smack bang in the Sea of Azov. So that's one reason. The second reason is that they want to take that city so they can then drive up north and potentially encircle a very large Ukrainian force that's sort of to the east of Ukraine, blocking the advance from Luhansk and Donetsk. And look, the third reason is just demonstration effect. And that's that Russia wants to show we can level the city of 450,000 people and there's nothing you can do about it.
There's also a lot of focus on the city of Odessa that's being watched closely as well. What about Kyiv, the capital? Are we likely to see an escalation there in the days ahead?
Well, we've certainly seen the Russians use some pretty heavy bombing against Kyiv. They flattened a shopping mall just a few hours ago. It does look as though they're going to try and dig in around Kyiv and just subject it to, you know, unguided artillery strikes to more or less do the same kind of thing that they've done to Mariupol and sort of test out how many civilians Zelensky is willing to potentially see die. It's a very brutal way to wage war.
We've got the Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky. He's still in Ukraine. The government still seems to be functioning underground. What about talks with Vladimir Putin? He's calling for those. Do you think it could happen and we could see some kind of a ceasefire?
Look, I think the only reason that we would see direct talks between Zelensky and Putin is if Putin's decided to cut his losses. And even then, I'm not sure Putin would meet with Zelensky directly. I think it'd be much more at the sort of defense minister, deputy prime minister level, which is what we've got now. The Russians have sent as their lead negotiator someone who is on record as saying Ukrainians don't exist as a people and they're full of Nazis and you know, they should be eliminated. So there's questions over, in fact, whether that negotiating team at the moment is serious and whether Putin, in fact, is really interested in the diplomatic outcome.
We had over the weekend Australia announce that we're sending more support to Ukraine, including 70,000 tonnes of coal. Why is that important?
So, I mean, it seems at first glance, you know, sort of counterintuitive. Why would you be sending, you know, coal to the Ukrainians? What are they going to do, throw it at the Russians? But there is actually a serious reason behind it, and that is that Ukraine relies for a lot of its power on nuclear reactors, some of those have to be taken offline because of the proximity of the fighting. So the question is, well, where does it get power from otherwise? And the answer is, well, you know, it gets power from fossil fuel generated sources. And so in that respect, although it looks strange, sending coal to Ukraine actually does serve a humanitarian purpose, just to help people keep the lights on.
All right. Well, we'll definitely be watching to see what happens over the next few days. We are leading up to a month, I think, this week of this war raging on. Matthew Sussex from ANU, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks so much, Dave.
Hack on Triple J.
That was Dr. Matthew Sussex from ANU, and that's all we've got time for on the Hack podcast for now. I'll catch you next time.